Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started today for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
Give the gift of absence to those who do not appreciate your presence. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child.
What you holding on to? Just let it all go. What's making you slow now? Just let it all go.
Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show. I'm an adult child of an alcoholic and dysfunctional family. I'm a recovering alcoholic. And I am super pumped because I'm about to drive down to Orlando to go to a podcast conference. But first, tomorrow, I am going to the new Universal Park Epic, which has a new Harry Potter section that I have yet to check out. Hello, my fellow Harry Potter lovers. So who has been to Epic? And there's also a Super Nintendo World that I'm jazzed about. So for all of us millennials, kids born in the 80s and early 90s, I see you. This one's for you. So this is the podcast where we don't just talk about Harry Potter and Nintendo 64, where we also talk about what the hell to do when you realize your childhood screwed you up more than you initially thought. We curse here. You've been warned. Welcome aboard this hot mess of a healing ship. So today, folks, we are diving deep with returning guest, psychotherapist, author, Dr. Sharon Martin. This is a deep dive into all things no contact, estrangement, boundaries. She has a new book out. Well, it's like a year old, I think, now. It is called Cutting Ties with Your Parents. She also has a great workbook called The Better Boundaries Workbook. So we're diving into all that shit. Okay, so let's just get on with the damn show so I can get myself out the damn door and on the road. Hi, Cheeto. Kitty is joining us. But first, let's talk about what you, yes, you need to damn the join shit show, my online support community, where we have a minimum of 6 weekly Zoom support groups where you can connect with fellow shit shows, other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal. This is a support community at your fingertips, in your back pocket, that you can access either through the web or on an app on your phone. We have a 24/7 hour chat. We have a ton of small groups that are focused on various interests or struggles. This is a support community that's actually fun to be a part of. It's not just like a 12-step recovery. We do talk about that, but we talk about all the various healing modalities and resources there. So this is truly a complex trauma healing community for peers. This is relational trauma, folks. We heal relational trauma through safe relationships. This is the place where you can do so for less than a damn dollar a day. Okay, so you, yes, you, yes, you, yes, you, yeah, you, I'm talking about you, who's been wanting to join for forever but hasn't yet done it. Let's just do it already. Okay, let's have it be today. You can see the link in the show notes, or you can head to adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow. Next, give me a follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at adultchildpod. And last but not least, whatever you do, please, 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 and I mean it, give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Thank you. Love you all. All right, folks. Well, she's back. Do you go by Dr. Sharon Martin?
Well, you can just call me Sharon. I mean,
doctors in the house.
Yeah, I mean, technically, but let's keep it casual.
Let's keep it casual. Okay, Cher. Author of the not so new, what about a year old, Better Boundaries Workbook?
Yeah. No, well, that one's a couple years old. Yeah, that was the second book that I wrote. So, and then the newer one is The Cutting Ties with Your Parents.
Oh, shit. Okay, now it makes sense, because I was wondering why. I don't know if Michelle told you about how I was going to interview this woman that she had recommended to me, who came out with a new book.
And it was about, I thought that it was about when adult children decide to go no contact with their narcissistic parents. But then it turned out to be about when parents are estranged from their adult children because their spouse has convinced them that their parent is a narcissist.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And once I read through the book and I saw that there was nothing about, I'm not saying that that's not something that could happen.
Right.
Okay. I'm sure that happens,
mm-hmm.
but there's nothing in there about looking at the role that the parent might play. There was a section was like, here are some of the things that your child might say to you. And it's like all the shit that people in my community would say to their parents of, you know, I've been like revisiting my childhood and saying like those were like warning signs. And so I was like, I can't in good faith recommend this book. And then so then Michelle wrote back saying that's why I like Sharon's book so much more. And I was like thinking, that's so weird. What is better boundaries of this? I was like looking for the second. So now I get it. Okay. Well, shit.
Let's
still talk about that. I want to talk about boundaries though for a second. Okay.
Okay. Yes. It's all related.
It's all related. Tell me, what did boundaries look like in your home growing up?
I mean, that's a good question. When I was growing up, people didn't use the term boundaries. Mm-hmm. We talked about things like rules or expectations. Those would have been the closest ideas. And those are certainly decent synonyms and, you know, at least some situations, you know. So I would say that, there were pretty clear rules and expectations in my family growing up. I definitely had struggles around also really high expectations for myself. So I would have, you know, the expectations from my parents. And of course, then I internalized and I think probably magnified also. But I think that was helpful to know what my parents expected of me so that I could try to meet those expectations.
Could you? Or was it a never-ending rising bar?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, I think probably if I step back and look at my family compared to other families, there were probably reasonably expectations that most people could meet. So they weren't really over the top, impossible things. Again, I think part of that became what I expected of myself was probably even more than what my parents expected of me. But again, it's really a combination of things because I didn't, you know, just come up with that stuff on my own. I think my parents, you know, did have high expectations, but probably not impossibly high expectations. And there was probably more room, I think, for them to be understanding of me making mistakes than I thought there was. Mm. So there's that combination, I think, of the expectations and rules that they were setting and then the boundaries that I was creating for my own self, right, to manage my own behavior that were going on.
And did that translate into also maybe having unrealistic or too high of standards for other people, like when in adulthood?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's all part of the same thing. And again, sometimes people are more so, you know, the expectations about themselves, but I think it's also very common that it translates over to you have high expectations of yourself, then you have high expectations of other people. And then, of course, that inevitably leads to feeling disappointed in people, upset with people for not meeting your expectations. And sometimes that is even expectations that you aren't communicating to them. I think that's probably the biggest problem is, you know, I would have expectations, but I didn't necessarily communicate them thinking, oh, well, you should just know that I'm expecting you to do these things. And then they don't.
And then you're
I'm
resentful.
Upset. Right. I'm upset. I'm disappointed. I'm resentful. I feel like I can't count on you about things. But even I think sometimes when the expectations are communicated, it was still like, okay, it doesn't need to be that rigid. There's probably more room for flexibility. And that's really one of the big things that I've learned about boundaries are they don't have to be this hard and fast, like this is the line, as if it's a non-negotiable boundary. And I think a lot of times when we talk about boundaries, that's what we're imagining is I'm drawing the line in the sand. And if you cross it, you know, there's some terrible consequence that's going to happen here. But the majority of boundaries are actually things that we can negotiate with people, or there's room for compromise, especially if these are people that we're close to. And this is, I'm not talking about things that are real safety issues. Mm-hmm. There's certainly a place for the hard and fast non-negotiable boundaries, especially around safety. But again, the majority of the boundaries, right, that we're setting with people are things that those are needs that we could meet in a variety of different ways. It doesn't necessarily have to be me dictating, this is what you have to do, or this is what I expect for you. It could be more like, you know, I have a need to spend more quality time with you, or I have a need to know what time you're going to be home from work so I can, you know, make plans or something like this. Like, we could figure out a variety of different ways to deal with that situation. It doesn't have to be me saying, you know, you have to do this.
Yeah, that brings up an interesting point. And one of the things that I was going to bring up is in noticing when and I don't think that this is conscious most of the time, but noticing when a boundary is really just like a subtle way of trying to like change or fix someone.
Well, it is sometimes.
I know, but I mean, not in a healthy way. Like in a way that we can't change or fix that person, you know?
Right. Well, I would say when the person is not willing to look at other ways of accomplishing that. So maybe we should just use an example.
Yes, please.
So let's just say, you know, there's a couple and one person is saying, I don't like the things that you're doing on social media. I see you making comments on, let's just say it's a heterosexual couple, and you know, the woman saying, hey, I see you're making some comments on some, you know, other women's pages or whatever. Yeah. And you know, this is making me uncomfortable and I want you to stop. So that's the boundary that she has set. She said, you need to stop making comments on other women's pictures. And so here's a great example that we can say, okay, well, what is it that she needs in this situation? And is this the only way that that can be accomplished? Because again, we'll just assume in this scenario that the partner is saying, hey, that feels controlling. I don't want to do that. I feel like I should be free to comment on other, you know, women's things. And, you know, this is all, you know, there's nothing for you to be concerned about. And this isn't romantic or sexual or, you know, anything like that.
Yes, and my second cousin.
Right. That may be the case. And again, we don't even need to know the whole background history here, or what the story is that's driving, you know, both of their responses for our example here. But I would say, and again, in almost all situations, there's various boundaries that could be set, or again, various ways that they can negotiate the situation where they can come to an agreement that they can both feel like they're getting their needs met, or most of their needs met most of the time, because, you know, we don't always get what we need in every single situation, every single minute of the day, right? But this is where, if we can go a little bit deeper, then we can understand what people need and how to get that, instead of one person saying, this is the only way I can feel secure in this relationship is for it to be like this. Maybe there's an alternative. And again, this is something that people could have to, you know, they have to figure that out for themselves. You and I could spitball different ideas of things that they could do, but whether that's going to work for this particular couple, who knows? But when people are willing to work together to come up with the solutions or the potential solutions, that's where you have a relationship that's working. Like, we're working together to solve a problem. We care about each other's needs. We care about each other's feelings, rather than that first situation where it doesn't feel like either partner is really caring about what the other person needs or wants in this situation. They're just digging in their heels and saying, I want it this way. No, I'm not going to do that. Right. That's not a collaborative relationship where we're working together.
Yeah. And I would think that with the majority of my audience listening, though, it's probably like the boundaries that they have the hardest time setting are with people who genuinely aren't interested or capable of, you know, compromise or wanting to make sure both people get their needs met, you know?
Yeah, well, that's really important information to have. And I think if, you know, and again, this is really overly simplistic to separate people into two different categories, but for the sake of this conversation, let's just say, you know, if you can know for yourself who in your life is somebody who is interested in your needs, you feel like they genuinely care about you, is able to be invested in communication and problem solving. That's sort of one group of people that you can work with to negotiate these things and come up with workable solutions. And then if you've got another, you know, person or group of people who you say, you know what, I know in my heart, I know from the experiences that I've had with this person repeatedly, that they really aren't interested in what I need. They don't seem to care about my feelings. They really don't have my best interest at heart, right? You need a really different approach, because that is a completely different relationship, and it's probably a completely different goal that you have in setting the boundary.
Yeah, and I don't even know if it's fair to say they don't have my best I think it's probably that, you know, they're traumatized, like they're just not capable, as opposed to like it being some sort of a conscious decision on their part of kind of being intentionally malicious, which is like a lack of ability.
Yeah. You know, like somebody who's just like an emotionally immature person, like they're just limited in their ability to do this kind of stuff. Well, here I would say maybe we even then decide, you know, is this person like they might be limited in these areas? Do they have any interest or willingness in learning to communicate more with you and like doing any of this? And if not, again, then we're sort of back into this category of, okay, well, what is it that you're trying to accomplish here? Often I think the boundaries then are self-protective boundaries, and those are going to probably be more of the rigid boundaries where you're saying, you know what, this is absolutely what I need, and there's not a lot of wiggle room on this because it's a safety issue for me. I can't, you know, keep putting myself into a physically or emotionally unsafe situation with people. And if I care about them and I understand what their trauma history is and what their limitations are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that we sometimes forget that navigating conflict in a way is also like kind of boundary setting. And when we are navigating conflict, when we are setting a boundary, we have to get so clear on what part of this is fair to put on the other person and what part of this is being intensified because of my history, like my trauma. Yeah. Like what of this is not fair to put on the other person? Mm-hmm. You know, and getting like very clear on that, especially when it comes to describing like motive or intention. We have to be so mindful of that when we're navigating conflict, of what part of this is intensified because of my past.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And that's not easy to do because you really have to slow down and, you know, kind of step out of it in order to do that. Because when you're in the moment, it all feels very valid and real, and it's hard to see, have any perspective on what's going on. And like you said, what are you bringing to this, or, you know, sort of overlaying on the other person that hasn't been said, or you're making assumptions about what they're doing or why they're doing it.
Why they're doing it. Yeah. That part of it is not fair.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and I think if you can be curious, if you can ask more questions, it's going to hopefully help you understand more about what the other person's motives are and what's going on with them. I mean, this is, you know, I find this to be so true in all relationships, is it is so hard to separate out your own perspective, not even just in conflict, but just in general. We just go through life without realizing how much we are assuming that other people are thinking about things the same way that we are, or, you know, understanding the world in the same way that we are. So many things that just, you know, are so basic to who we are and the way we operate in the world. It's just still amazes me. I mean, that how different we all are, even if we know people really well, or we have a lot of things in common with them, we can just still see at least certain things just fundamentally differently. And like you were saying, I mean, just ascribe a totally different understanding to a situation. And again, if you don't really have a discussion and ask questions about that, you won't even know that somebody else's, you know, point of view is really different.
Yeah. And I think it's also, we can get trapped in spending so much time and trying to figure out the other person and analyze the other person. And it's really just a subconscious way of not having to self-reflect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think that's intentional either, but you know.
No, you know, like you were, you know, saying, I mean, so, who learns about the importance of self-reflection growing up, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not the kind of thing that, you know, most families talk about or encourage, you know, so I think it's something that, you know, it's probably going to feel kind of strange. And then I think we're always just so busy and there's so much pressure to be doing things all of the time that it's not something that most people naturally have sort of built into their life is mm-hmm. a way to make time for self-reflection, either sort of like in a larger chunk of it or even the small bits. It's just, you know, react, and I think that's, you know, just get seems like it's just getting more and more so with technology, is, you know, the expectation that you're going to respond to everything immediately is really intense, and that doesn't help us with this, you know, important piece of you need to pause. And I mean, and I say pause, and that sort of implies that's just like a few seconds. And sometimes that might be all it takes.
Sometimes it could be a week.
Yes. Sometimes you need a lot of time to process things and go back to them, you know, and sometimes you just uncover layer upon layer the more that you, you know, reflect. And then I think even if you're in therapy or you have even some trusted friends or other people that you're talking to about, getting other perspectives also is going to help you investigate and, you know, understand your own thoughts and feelings and ideas about all of this as well. And then you use that, and that sort of helps you again process a little bit more deeply and reflect a little bit more and have greater self-understanding.
I think for me, it's like whenever I feel that sense of urgency, like that is a big sign for me to not do anything.
Well, that's really smart. And I mean, I don't think there are that many people that have figured that out.
Well, that's clearly coming from like it's a fight flight response, you know, like when I feel that uptick, it's not rational. So I'm curious, I think that with people with complex trauma, you know, like our boundary system is not so much like you just have to like learn to set boundaries. It's understanding like how much of it is just defense mechanisms that you developed as a kid, whether it's, you know, you have no boundaries or you have, you know, concrete walls around you.
Right.
So I'm curious, when you reflect back on your career as a therapist, have you worked with many people to where like their boundaries just like way, way, way too rigid? And how do you kind of work through that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just like you said, I mean, you know, some people really lack the ability to set many boundaries at all. And then there are other people who have these very rigid walls around them. And then there's also people that kind of go back and forth. They'll sort of swing from it's so rigid to then not enough boundaries. And it's, you know, and they're kind of
disorganized attachers doing
a little bit of both. But I also think, you know, a real piece of what you're talking about is feeling safe, trusting people. Because again, those rigid walls are there to protect you. That's why you're doing it, right? You've been hurt. It's natural to want to wall yourself off so that other people can't hurt you anymore. So I think if you start from that place of saying, this is understandable, this makes sense that I am doing this. Because if you feel like the alternative is to be vulnerable and to be right, putting yourself in situations where you're going to be hurt, because that's what your experience has been, then of course it's preferable to wall yourself off and keep yourself safe. So I think what we want to do is remember that we don't just have these two alternatives, right? We don't have to be vulnerable or isolated and afraid and walled off, right? What we're looking for is the middle ground, and feeling like that's something that you can control, I think, is really important. You know, sometimes we use the analogy of a boundary being like with a gate, so yeah. that you can open and close the gate there. And I like that because that feels okay. That's up to me. I can open and close the gate. I can let in who I want to let in, or I can let them in a little bit or not, right? And that's something that feels empowering when it feels like I have control over that rather than, you know, other people are deciding that, or it's out of my control and I don't know who's going to be coming in and what they're going to be doing. But the boundary is your ability to keep yourself safe. And you want to feel like that's something that you are able to do for yourself. And so I think, like I was saying, part of this is feeling like you know how to trust your own judgment about who's safe and who's not. And that's huge, right? That's not
that
an
takes
easy
time.
Yeah, it's not an easy undertaking, right? Just, I mean, the idea of learning to trust your own judgment and feel like you're, you know, able to do that for yourself. But absolutely, I mean, just the idea of how do you know if somebody is trustworthy is a difficult question to answer. And it's not something like you're going to, you know, be able to decide that today. It's probably honestly a question that you continue to assess and ask yourself over and over again about people. As you have different interactions with them, you're gathering more information and you're using that to say, okay, you know, how does this feel? And something that's, again, is like you were saying earlier, it's the ability to tune into yourself, to reflect, connect with yourself and say, okay, how is this feeling for me? And what is that telling me? Right? What are the emotions? What's my body telling me about the interaction with this person in terms of whether it's safe or unsafe?
Okay, let's talk about going no contact. I'm curious, have there been any pivotal moments in your career that really shifted your thoughts on that? Or maybe like, you know, I don't know, earlier on, if you were giving someone like feedback or suggestions and you realized maybe that's not the right way to go about it?
Well, I don't know if this is exactly the answer to that question. But what I really recognized going on with a lot of my clients was that they were coming in really week after week talking about how painful the interactions were with their parents or sometimes with their in-laws and how stuck they felt in those relationships and in those interactions that they did not see a way to, I would say, make it better or to remove themselves
different.
From, yeah. Like, and they really, I would say for the majority of them, not all of them, but for a certain number of them, that the idea of no contact was just really not an option that they were imagining. They were very much in the mindset of, this is an obligation. This is something I have to keep doing. I don't have a choice about it. I have to keep, you know, going to the holidays and the birthday parties and, you know, showing up when my parents call and ask me to do something for them, that there was so much heaviness and so much guilt and shame around all of it, that they spent so much of their time dealing with this, that it was suffocating. And I'm not even, you know, getting into, you know, the specific things that were painful about these interactions, but just how all-encompassing this had become for them. That, you know, the family relationships were just such a source of pain for them, and yet they didn't really know that there were options, that this was something that maybe they could do less of or not do at all. And so anyway, I had a number of clients who just wrestled with this, and what became apparent, and this is very anecdotal, you know, information that I'm sharing with you, you know, from a small group of people that I was seeing in therapy. But I think probably to some extent, I was honestly surprised a bit by how much better people felt when they took space from those relationships, either permanently or temporarily. And I say that not because it was like, oh, automatically everything was better and this was, you know, so easy or anything like that, because it wasn't. It was still very painful, but there was a tremendous amount of relief and, I don't know, sort of like emotional freedom that came with it, that suddenly there was space for other things in people's lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was still a lot of healing that needed to be done, of course, but all of the time and energy that had been spent daily, weekly on those painful relationships and recovering from the painful interactions or worrying about them before they happened or replaying them in their minds afterwards, like all of that stuff that was taking up so much time and space for people, now there was space for other things.
Mm-hmm. When you really dig into, like you're speaking of, people didn't even consider it an option. Mm-hmm. I know it's not one size fits all, but I'm curious, like when you really peel back the layers, how much of it is a fear of backlash? Mm-hmm. How much of it is a fear of judgment, not even necessarily yep. from their family, but from other people?
Yep.
Yeah, I'm just like curious as what you see being kind of like the real driving force underneath yep. that.
Well, I would say that's it. I think that's a huge part of it. And sometimes that was very conscious. Like people were consciously aware that there were specific people that they knew who would disapprove, or that cutting ties with their parents would also mean losing contact with a sibling or some extended family members, grandparents or other people as well. And that was really painful as well, realizing that. But I would say that, yeah, the biggest one really is that there's blame and there's judgment. And as you know, I mean, in these situations, these are people who had already been experiencing so much blame and judgment and manipulation within their family. And I think probably most of the times it had already been set up this way so that, you know, it's like they had been conditioned to believe that they were the problem. And so, you know, the family had already been sort of setting the narrative, you know, that you're bad, you're difficult, you're the issue in the family. And so if anything goes wrong, we have our scapegoat right here. And so they knew, I mean, it was obvious that when they step back, the family is going to say it's because Andrea's, you know, a loose cannon, or, you know, she's so difficult, she's so demanding, or, you know, whatever the story is that people have in their particular family. But, you know, that becomes what everyone repeats and magnifies.
I call that shit out, you know? And it's kind of interesting because I feel like, as my parents are very sick, but they also, it's so interesting with my family because, like, we've always known that alcoholism is a problem, you know, like it's just always been part of the discussion. So there's like all this like knowledge, but I'm the only one that's done anything about it. So it's so like dysfunctional and sick, but at the same time, like we're all kind of in the know, like they're kind of in the know, you know?
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, it's.
Well, yeah, that's the interesting thing. It's like everybody knows, but nobody talks about mm-hmm. it. Or
yeah,
just
are we just, I'm like, oh, we're doing this shit again? Cool. Okay. Yeah, right. It's Andrea's problem.
mm-hmm. I mean, and I think that's probably really good, but a lot of families.
Oh, no, it's not. I mean, right. It's a very unique situation that I'm.
Yeah. I was going to say, most people don't feel like they can do that.
What about this? I think that a lot of times when I'm talking to people about whether they want to go no contact with their parents or not, I think it's so important that we realize that. And I'm curious if you see this with your clients, is I feel like people feel like we're making like a lifelong decision.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be.
No, absolutely. And I think you're right. I think people want it to sort of fit into a nice little box and say, this is what it is. I mean, and even when we talk about, you know, estrangement or cutting ties, we use these terms without really defining what they mean, and they may mean different things to different people, but in most cases it is very fluid. certainly there are some people who cut ties or go no contact, and that is absolutely no contact, and that is enduring and it lasts for the rest of their lifetime. But that's probably the exception, really. It's much more common that people do some variation of this. They have some contact, or they move back and forth between contact and no contact, or you know, a little contact, and it's depending on what's going on in the family, what's going on in the world. Yeah, so it isn't something that either you need to go into saying, this is what I'm doing for 6 months, or this is what I'm doing forever. You don't need to know.
Would there ever be a circumstance where it would be appropriate for someone to announce this to a family member and specifically spell out that this is forever and ever, amen?
Well, I would say if that feels like it's useful and helpful or healing for somebody to do, then do it. If it doesn't, then don't do it. Again, there might be people who are pressuring you to, you know, do something like that, you know, make some declaration of what does this mean, or how long are you going to, you know, not be a part of the family, or again, sort of use it as a guilt and shame tactic to have people sort of pressured into making decisions about something. But I think for most people, it's something that you can say to yourself, again, I can sort of reassess this. If it feels like it's not working anymore, or I don't need to do this anymore, or I want to give it another try, that's something that you can, you know, be open to. Obviously, you can't control what other people are going to do. There's certainly the possibility that if you're stepping away from family relationships and thinking to yourself, well, you know, maybe at some point I'm going to go back and, you know, try again. It is possible that your parents, your family members are not interested at that point. I mean, that is a possibility that we don't have any control over.
Yeah, I think that one thing that's important is that, especially if you're like in early stages of healing.
Yeah.
It can be really difficult to actually heal when you are consistently being re-triggered by the people that are at the hands of the trauma that you're trying to heal from.
Yeah.
I do think, though, in some circumstances, and not in all, I do think in certain cases, you can heal and you can revisit the relationships from a place of, I have a more grounded sense of self. I know how to handle myself with triggers. I know how to have better boundaries. So I think that there are certain circumstances where, like, we can take a break and really focus on our own healing and maybe revisit the relationship, like, in a way in which we weren't able to before, even if they haven't changed at all, you know? But that's not for everyone.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a really good point that you're making. And again, I like it because it feels really empowering. That's something that I can control. I can learn coping skills. I can learn how to regulate my nervous system. I can learn how to set boundaries. I can understand my triggers. And so I could go into these situations being prepared, being able to use those skills, and also knowing when to, again, leave those situations and not just leave myself vulnerable there, or feel like I'm obligated to stick around for the abuse, right? So that is a good option, but it isn't the option for everybody. And that's okay. Also, I think that's probably one of the most important things, you know, for people to understand is everybody's situation is different. Your family dynamics are different. Your needs are different. And what's right for one person doesn't have to be right for you. And you don't need to feel bad about that if that doesn't feel like it would work for you or something that you want to do. Because again, I think so much of this has to come back to trusting yourself and knowing what's right for you. And that is valid, whatever it is. And that is something that will change over time. And I think that goes back to what you were talking about is you may make a decision about how much contact you want with family members today. And that might be a different decision that you make a month from now or a year from now or 5 years from now. Because even if nothing changes with them, you are going to change.
Have you witnessed where you have a client where it it is hard for them to make progress because they are just habitually re-traumatizing themselves by staying in contact with, you know, whoever it might be.
Yeah. 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 I would say that, you know, that was a lot of the group of people that I was talking about earlier is absolutely. I mean, they were spending so much of that time and energy just, you know, sort of treading water, just trying to get through it, that there wasn't really anything left for, you know, it was sort of say healing or sort of forward progress in their life. It was just about maintaining what was, you know, keeping their head above water here so that they could keep going. Yeah. And it is rough because there is a lot of trauma that is continuing to go on. Mm-hmm. I mean, right. I mean, it seems like that should be obvious, but some people talk about family estrangement as if this isn't obvious that there's ongoing trauma. It's not just traumatic things that happen to people in their childhood. Not that those aren't important, but in every situation that I have experienced where an adult is cutting ties with their parents, it's because the parent is continuing to cause them harm in the present.
Yeah, I realized about that about myself, about how much I minimized like what the impact of the past like 10 years mm-hmm. has been like with my family, you know, because it was a lot less, it was a lot less chaotic and dysfunctional like when I was a kid, you know, just seeing there's something like so tragic about having that family that was like, it wasn't great, but it was like not so bad, you know, mm-hmm. and like feeling like at one point you had a sense of a family and then just to have that not even be there anymore. And just the way that overt abuse got so much, it just became much more overt. But then with the understanding of coming it from like an intellectualized perspective of, I understand they're sick. Like, I understand it's not about me, you know? And so then you don't recognize the grief because you're just kind of like minimizing it. Oh, it's not really about you, but it wrecked me. It really, I didn't realize like how much of that I was stuffing. And still, I think some of that stuff I won't be able to fully grieve until they're gone. But I think mm-hmm. that we really minimize like the impact of what happens to us in adulthood because we might come to it with the perspective of, I get that they're, you know, that they're traumatized, that like this is their own wounding, and somehow that we feel as though that makes the impact to us like less so, but it's not the case.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's so much normalizing of it that happens in the family. But I think, like you're saying, there's also a lot of pressure from outside and from your own self to minimize it as well. It's really hard to acknowledge just how painful and how dysfunctional your own family is. And especially your parents to acknowledge the harm that they are causing you. I mean, because just the concept of that is overwhelming. I mean, mm-hmm. because it goes against everything that you want to believe about your parents and that you've been taught about how parents are supposed to be treating their kids, right? They're supposed to be loving their children and building them up and, you know, doing all these wonderful things. And it's really hard to acknowledge that that's not what's going on, right? That your parents are not doing that or, you know, not, you know, doing that some of the time, because then you're also left with the question of why. And I think, like you said, even if intellectually you can say, oh, alcoholism, that's probably not a real satisfying answer, right? It's true. But I think it gets down to a lot of those really painful beliefs about ourselves that get planted early on, right? That has to be something about me too.
Yeah. Well, it's also like cognitively coming to terms with the fact that there's nothing that you can do to save your mom, mm-hmm. but just really realizing it, that like, I still had a part that like had really not grieved that and just felt like a total and utter failure, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's so different, the part of you that can intellectualize it and cognitively understand what is going on, and then that emotional part of you, whether, you know, you want to think about that as your inner child or, you know, whatever sort of resonates
just like living
with
in
you.
The body. Like I didn't get, like, I didn't get the body keeps the score. Like I just thought about it from the perspective of like autoimmune issues or like horrible chronic pain. And I just realized like, holy shit, I've been living in functional freeze. I get it now. I get it. It's non-negotiable.
Yeah, but if you if that's the way you've always lived, I think to your point, you don't realize that not everybody is living that way.
Yeah, until you do, and you realize you've been living with your shoulders up to your glued to your ears, your like starting to be horrible, like structural neck and shoulder issues. It catches up. It catches up.
Absolutely, but I think you're right. I mean, it's often much more subtle. Mm-hmm. Until it's not subtle anymore, but for a lot of people for a long time, it's just sort of there in the background, like this chronic stress in their body that just, it's maybe uncomfortable, but it's also very much normal to you.
You don't know any different.
Yeah.
You know, I think I just thought about it from the perspective of my trauma wasn't impacting me unless I was in a relationship and not realizing that I always was in a low-grade sense of hypervigilance.
Yeah.
So I'm curious what you think about this because, you know, we can look at like the word narcissism and see how like it's kind of become trendy, overused. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if we're seeing that at all when it comes to estrangement and no contact, if there's some, if people are capitalizing off that at all, or, you know, I even think about it from, I've had like friendships end where I just made a post about this, about how like labeling someone as toxic, I think has become like a shortcut for some people to avoid self-reflection, you know? And so I think that most of the time, I don't know. I just think that there is a lot of that going on out there, maybe not necessarily with parents, but I do think that people cut other people off, just like completely ghost them. A lot of it is like, I cannot have a difficult conversation.
Yeah, there's sort of a weird contradiction. It seems like we're on the one hand, in certain situations, there's a lot of support for just cutting people off. And then in other situations, there's a lot of blaming and shaming and saying, oh, no, don't do that. That's a terrible thing to do. And I don't know if it's as clear cut as one is with family and one is with non-family.
Yeah,
it's
no.
Probably not quite that simplistic, but a bit of that.
I'm sure that there are toxic family members that cut other family members off, like by labeling them toxic.
Yeah,
when it really is about anytime I have a conversation with you, like you're a mirror up to my face and I don't want to have to look at myself.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense as well. But it, again, it's really hard to have a perspective about what part of this is me. What am I contributing to the relationship problems here? What is the other person bringing? And as you were saying it, you know, earlier in our conversation, what part of this dynamic is also maybe triggering my old trauma stuff and bringing that out and giving me a really big reaction to what's going on here? And maybe what's going on here really isn't as, you know, dramatic or big as it seems to me. And it's something that we could work out. Mm-hmm. So I think they're really good, but really hard questions.
Yeah,
that we have to
fits all.
Yeah, but I mean, I think probably the most important thing is that we ask ourselves the question, even if the answer ultimately is, I think I did all that I could do in this relationship. I did my part in trying to communicate clearly and resolve the issues. You'll never know for sure 100%. There aren't going to be answers like that to these kinds of questions. But I think if you're asking yourself, you know, is there anything on my part that I could have done better, that I could have done differently here? You're probably a step ahead of most people if you're asking yourself those questions.
True.
Right. So at least ask yourself, even if, and if you don't know the answer, that's okay too. Again, maybe that's something that you just keep coming back to, not to beat yourself up over, because I think there's, you know, you can
absolutely
run the risk of doing that too, of also just trying to find fault with yourself where there isn't fault. But again, we also know that most relationship problems are, you know, it is possible that it is mostly one person, you know, causing the relationship problem. But there's a dynamic. There is a back and forth. So even if one person is, for lack of a better word, you know, mostly toxic in this mm-hmm. situation, they still might be bringing up something in you that you're maybe not handling in the best possible way. And that, again, that can just be information that you gather about yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. To circle back to, you know, when you're working with clients who don't even consider it a possibility to go no contact, what are sort of some of the questions or seeds that you're planting in their head to start having them actually consider this as actually a possibility for you?
Yeah, well, I guess I would say, first of all, I mean, it's not as if I'm trying to steer people
I know.
I just want to clarify for people listening yeah. so it doesn't come off that way, like that's my goal here.
Brainwashing them.
We want people to
Therapist that these parents right. complaining, like they're brainwashed by their therapists.
Yeah, there's a lot of that idea going mm-hmm. around. But obviously what we really want is for people to decide what's going to be best for themselves. And so I think sometimes, you know, we can just sort of try on the idea and imagine what it might be like, what might be some of the pros or the cons of making a choice, a different choice than the one you're making now. And considering that, thinking about what might be holding somebody back from seeing that as an option. And again, then we can understand what are the barriers. And again, that doesn't mean that they have to make the choice to cut ties, but they might gain some insight into why they're not considering that possibility.
And yeah. what are some things to take into consideration around how it's communicated or if it even is formally communicated?
Yeah, again, this is very much an individual
yep.
situation as to whether you're going to say something or not say something. I think, again, in just sort of very broad strokes, I mean, there's pros and cons either way in terms of whether you're going to explain your... And again, we could also just think about this more generally in terms of a boundary that we're setting. This is a particular boundary, how much contact I'm going to have with you. But even in other boundary situations, I think, again, there's a case to be made for saying clearly to somebody, this is what the boundary is that I'm setting and this is why I'm setting it. And other times just taking the action and just doing it. And I think in those situations, it's often we're not going to explain or say something because doing so would make the situation worse. It would enrage the other person. It would put us in danger. Or we have tried doing this before and we get so much pushback, manipulation, and it's turned around on you. It's an effort. It's just information that they use against you ultimately. So in those situations, you know, it seems like there's more harm than good that will come out of explaining it or making a statement or having a conversation sometimes. But I mean, I think if it's possible, certainly the more relational approach is to tell people what to expect from you, but that isn't always possible. And again, I think if people take the time to think through, why am I choosing to say something or not say something, and you understand for yourself how you came to that decision, then you'll be able to be more at peace with it. And I think ultimately that's the most important thing, because there's not going to be one right answer for everybody in terms of how to handle that.
Yeah. And I think one of the big things too is, and I think that this can also apply to whether or not we want to have a conversation with our parents about like us realizing how our childhood has impacted us. Mm-hmm. And I think that this would be applicable too for whether or not to explain why we're setting a boundary. It has to be coming from a place of, I am okay no matter how they respond to this. Mm-hmm. I'm saying this for me. How they react to it will not change
yeah.
whether I wanted to say this or not.
Sort of detach from the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So are you saying this for yourself, or are you saying this because you're hoping to get some sort of a reaction? And that's been most helpful for me. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, it's not worth it, right? But there are some times where it's, no, I need to say this for me.
Yeah.
So I think explanations when we're going into a toxic family, like people that we need to go no contact with, like an explanation is, it's not going to go through, you know?
Right. Yeah. They're simply not going to understand your point of view and say, oh, yes, I understand. That makes sense why you're doing that. I support you in this, right? It's not going to happen. But I think to your point, I mean, you have to ask yourself. I mean, I think it's important that you understand for yourself
what your reasons is. Absolutely. Are, right?
Yeah. And so the question then becomes, if I understand for myself, is that enough? Or is it also important for me to say it out loud, you know, for the other person, or put it in writing for the other person? And I think both approaches are certainly valid.
There ever be a circumstance where you feel like somebody's reasons to go no contact with their parent is actually coming from an unhealthy place?
Well, I think it's possible. On the one hand, I want to say it's really not my place to judge.
Yeah.
You know, so I kind of want to hold on to that. But yes, I mean, it is possible. I think anything's possible, right? Let's, you know, so as much as I think we say that the vast majority of time, these are not rash decisions. These are not just, you know, something that somebody hasn't thought through or tried to resolve the issues before they come to this. There are probably exceptions to that. I mean, there probably are, you know, occasionally people in situations where it's just a knee-jerk reaction to mm-hmm. something. But I'm not sure if we'd even put it in the same category. And this is where sometimes maybe the terminology is getting a little bit confused. And, mm-hmm. you know, what do we call estrangement or no contact? Or what do we call sort of an unhealthy giving somebody the silent treatment for the next 2 weeks? Right? Because that essentially looks like no contact, doesn't yeah. it? And we would say, well, that's probably unhealthy. So again, I mean, is the difference in understanding your reasons and communicating it or not communicating it, or what you do with the time? I mean, there's a lot of different, you know, variables in there that I think might make the difference between whether we call this healthy or unhealthy for people.
Are you going to write another book?
Yeah, I'm writing another book.
Are you sharing what the theme is?
No, I'm gonna keep you in suspense.
Is it completely different than what you've written about so far?
No, it's not. It's not completely different.
Is it a workbook or a book?
It's a book. But it's still a self-help book with a lot of, you know, reflective questions and some exercises and things. So
what's your process of writing?
Ah, goodness. Well, the process is spend a lot of time thinking about ideas, mulling things over, feeling frustrated that I don't have a better idea, feeling annoyed that I haven't figured it all out yet, trying to be patient until something kind of comes together. Mm-hmm. Like there's sort of a combination of being proactive and trying to get yourself to do some actual work that will promote some ideas, but also this sort of being patient until it just comes also. But once I get the idea and then I write an outline for it, honestly, that's probably the hardest part, is the outline and the organization of the whole thing. And then I basically write the chapters sequentially. But yeah, once I get going with it, it's much easier. For me, the hardest part is, figuring out what I'm going to write and what's going to be included in it. And then it's just do it.
Yeah, writing a book, but it same thing. I'll get so frustrated that, and then it's like after you get to that point of banging your head against the wall and then you just like don't care and then the idea comes.
Yeah.
You're like in the shower.
Yeah. I mean, just like, not that it's bad to ask, but you know, everyone's like, okay, are you going to write another book? What are you going to write about? It's sort of like, you know, if you graduate from high school or college and everyone's like, what are you going to do next? Yeah. Are you going to do this? When, mm-hmm. you know, like you start feeling this pressure, like, oh, okay, I'm supposed to be doing it. But, you know, it's, Probably like by the time from after I finished one book, like I spent like at least a year not writing anything really. I
Good.
mean, maybe some blog posts or, you know, this or that, but yeah, it just takes a while. I mean, it's like you kind of have to recover from one before you're ready to focus on something else also.
Unless you're like John Grisham or something.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there are people that just crank them out, but I think those are all, they tend to be sort of formulaic. Yeah, it's just sort of the same, a little bit
Same thing,
different.
yeah, just different names, locations, professions.
Yeah, but kind of the same idea. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I enjoy some of those books for sure. Yeah, it definitely takes me longer than that. But that's okay.
Well, thanks, Sharon. This was great. I'll put all the books in the show notes. So,
Awesome. Thank you so
of
much.
course.
What you're holding on to? Just let it all go. What's making you slow now? Just let it all go.
The new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at weightwatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk.